Welcome back to the Big Green Politics podcast.
We are back with another episode where we cover the global green politics news.
In this episode, we're going to talk about the new trade deal between the EU and Mercosur, the South American partnership comprising Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay.
All right, first off, on the last week of June, the first Democratic debates of the U.S. 2020 presidential primary were held in Miami. The location is important because Miami is a place, a state, that may not exist in 50 years due to the climate crisis. So because of that, and also given the fact that these are the Democrats, the leftists, you would assume they would talk extensively on how to tackle the climate crisis that we're in. Well, joke's on you. What happened in 2015 and 16 is pretty much happening right now as well. Back in 2015 and 16, 20 presidential primary debates were held, and only 1.5% of the questions were about climate change. When it came to the debates between Hillary and Donald Trump, there were no questions asked about climate change. This time around, admittedly, there is a bit more attention on the issue, so it went from 1.5 to 6%. But still, not enough time spent on them. Not everyone had a chance to weigh in on them. And the questions, to be honest, were very basic and not solution or policy oriented. And because of this, people are now mobilizing for a climate crisis debate. So let's see how that goes. But I think one of the reasons why the climate crisis is either not being discussed or not discussed in the right way or not enough is because the US Greens are not a part of the mainstream political conversation at all. But good news, turns out they're holding their primary debates as well. The first one is going to be held in Minnesota on the 19th of July. If you're interested in seeing that, we'll be sharing the link to that live stream on our Twitter page at Big Green Paw Pod.
At the start of May, we saw the UK Parliament declare a national climate emergency. This is the culmination of a wave of climate emergency motions happening at local government level across the country and also across Europe, kick-started by the very first one in Bristol, UK, in November 2018. So on the one hand, this is exciting news because it's an admission of the urgency of the problem, and most motions also set a clear target. So the original motion said carbon neutrality by 2030, but it also could be nothing but lip service if it's not followed up with concrete and bold action. And indeed, the UK government has been anything but green before and since the declaration. It approved the expansion of Heathrow Airport near London. It's increased its support for fossil fuel projects overseas. And the same thing's happening in Bristol, whose airport is facing expansion from 8 to 12 million passengers a year. So if you're wondering how we make climate emergency motions a tool rather than just empty words, tune in to our upcoming episode with the councillor who proposed the EU's very first climate emergency motion, Carla Denyer. So watch out for that.
There seems to be a pattern here in terms of governments not following up with their own climate emergency declarations. On the 17th of June, Canada's Parliament declared a climate emergency. The motion was brought forward by the Environment and Climate Change Minister, Catherine McKenna. She actually said about climate change, quote, real and urgent crisis driven by human activity, end of quote. So that's good, positive, great. And again, if you expect that the Canadian government, led by the progressive icon, Justin Trudeau, to properly follow up with this declaration and take actions accordingly, joke's on you. Only one day after declaring a climate emergency, so on the 18th of June, the same parliament approved the expansion of a massive pipeline that will increase oil production in Alberta, Canada, and release more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. This is really important because the upcoming Canadian federal elections are going to be held in this October, and there's a huge wave over there as well. We'll be covering this topic in an interview with a Green Canadian politician very soon, so stay tuned for that as well.
So, big news from the EU last week, when we heard who's likely to fill Europe's five most powerful positions. German Defence Minister Ursula von der Leyen was nominated European Commission President. Left-wing Spanish Minister Josep Borrell will be the EU's High Representative for Foreign Affairs. Belgian Acting Prime Minister Charles Michel will replace Donald Tusk as President of the Council. And the President of the Central Bank will be former IMF Director Christine Lagarde. And the European Parliament also voted for its own president, and they chose Italian left-winger David Sassoli. Greens have critiqued the appointments, not only because of the neoliberal ideology behind candidates such as Christine Lagarde. Firstly, the Greens' increase in power and their new position as fourth largest group was not reflected in these positions, and their demand for a climate and energy commissioner was ignored, but also because the Spitzen candidate system, which Greens favoured to appoint to these positions, where each of the parliamentary groups puts forward their own candidate for each position, was ignored in favour of backroom deals by the council. The parliament does get a say on the commission president in mid-July, so let's see what happens.
Speaking of the EU, they have just struck a trade pact, a trade deal with Mercosur, a bloc comprising Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay. The gist of the deal is it will cut or remove trade tariffs, which will make imported products cheaper for consumers, while also boosting exports for companies on both sides. So the deal will create a market for goods and services, which will cover nearly 800 million consumers.
That is the largest deal in the world, right? In terms of population.
Exactly. Yes. So, and this is a continuum of many trade agreements the EU has been concluding with many different countries, including Canada and Japan. In fact, since 2014, deals with 15 countries have entered into force. So this agreement adds four more countries to that list.
Whew, they've been busy.
Well, thanks for that input, Julia.
No worries.
Moving on. What this trade deal will mean in practice is it'll make it cheaper for Brazilian farmers to export agricultural products, especially beef, to the European Union countries. In return, European businesses will get greater access to the markets of these four countries, but it'll especially benefit producers of vehicles, chemicals, machinery, wine, and cheese. And of course, there are always two sides to every political story like this deal. One is how a deal is branded and portrayed by the parties. The other one is its real impact and what it's actually going to do in reality.
Mm-hmm.
How this deal has been branded by the EU. So I've taken this paragraph from the EU Commission's website. It says, quote, "This deal will consolidate a strategic, political, and economic partnership and create significant opportunities," this is the funny part, "for sustainable growth on both sides, while respecting the environment and preserving interests of EU consumers and sensitive economic sectors," end of quote. And we're going to be tackling all these claims. And then the Commissioner for Trade, Cecilia Malmström, said, quote, "It also sets high standards and establishes a strong framework to jointly address issues like the environment and labor rights, as well as reinforcing sustainable development commitments we've already made, for example, under the Paris Agreement." So in three words, this deal has been branded as an open, sustainable, and rule-based trade act. But let's talk about reality now. Of course, Brazilian farmers exporting agricultural products, especially beef, to EU countries is going to have a huge impact on both sides of the Atlantic. So let's first focus on what will happen in South America, or Brazil to be specific.
Yes, so let's look at this deal's ecological impact to start with. In two words, this deal is an ecological nightmare. It's been opposed by Greens all over Europe, and more than 100 NGOs who claim it amounts to, and this is how Greenpeace put it, to a disaster for the environment on both sides of the Atlantic. So let's talk about why. For the EU to import beef and poultry from across the Atlantic when it can and does already produce its own is bad enough.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem here is more the environmental destruction it will inevitably lead to, which is already really severe and growing in places like Brazil. Because as you said, we're talking about beef production. That's going to be one of the major things that Mercosur is exporting to the EU. And beef production is the major cause of deforestation in South America.
And let's also make it clear that it's because of cattle farming, right?
Yeah.
So nearly 80% of deforested areas in Brazil are now used for pasture for the animals.
Absolutely.
And this practice or this tradition actually goes way back to the 16th century, the beginning of the Portuguese colonization, when navigators brought the first animals to satisfy farmers' demand for milk and, you know, animal draught. So this is the environmental part of it. But remember the EU commissioner's quote when she said labor rights? Cattle ranching actually has the highest rates of slave labor in Brazil.
Wow.
So like last year, just over 3,000 people held as slaves were freed from those cattle farms and ranches.
Wow, that is just staggering.
Yeah.
And indeed, this deal looks like it's going to increase this practice, which, as you say, is very ancient.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also rooted in really ancient and very Western and imperialist ways of thinking about mm-hmm. nature and about production, as I'll explain a bit more later about Bolsonaro and his views on indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so the agreement would increase beef production exponentially because it would allow Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay and Uruguay to export 99,000 tons of beef annually to the European Union. And as you said, this would involve a huge amount of the Amazon rainforest and the Cerrado as well, which is a part of Brazil that people are less intrigued by, right? Because it's not the Amazon rainforest, it's not the lungs of the world, but it's 20% of Brazil and it's this huge like savanna.
Exactly. And it's being used for this purpose as well.
Exactly. And these are lands that are really rich in biodiversity and in like rare plants and animals, and they're homes for people as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the clearest proof of the impact this is going to have on the environment is contained in a new investigation by the NGO Traza, which is based in Stockholm.
Mm-hmm.
And it tracks supply chains and the impact of the beef on our plates, in our burgers and on our barbecues. And they did this country breakdown about where our meat comes from. And they revealed that meat consumers in Britain were indirectly responsible for up to 500 football pitches of land clearance in Brazil last year. And Italy, which is the biggest Brazilian beef buyer in the EU, mm-hmm. chewed through about four times as much. So this is an incredible amount of beef that we're talking about.
So this is before the new trade deal.
Yes. So this is
before all that meat coming into the EU.
Yeah, exactly.
So imagine with all the reductions entering into force, like reduction of tariffs.
Yeah, exactly. It's gonna go wild. And Brazil is the world's slaughterhouse. And, you know, this is a time of record beef exports. We're eating more beef than ever, which is crazy considering how much vegetarianism and veganism seems to be spreading. But I guess we are all in our little echo chambers.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a crazy stat. In 2018, 1.6 million tons of steak and other types of beef were sent overseas from Brazil.
Wow.
And that is beating the previous record in 2007. And both of these have been preceded by huge peak in forest clearances.
Yeah. And actually, China is Brazil's biggest customer for beef and soy. According to that same research,
mm-hmm.
they're actually responsible for 75 times more deforestation than the UK. So
wow.
UK was 500 football pitches. They're 75 times more. So like when you look at the big picture, the threat these forests are facing,
mm-hmm.
even before the new trade deal, It's incredible.
Yeah, it's already a huge problem,
mm-hmm.
and we're just making it worse.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Brazil is home to 60% of the Amazon rainforest, and it's a cliche, but the Amazon rainforest they really are the lungs of the world.
Mm-hmm.
because not only are they home to people, to amazing rare species of insects, animals, plants, some of which are as yet undiscovered, some of whose properties could be really important to us in the future, mm-hmm. but also because we need the Amazon rainforest for our survival, because trees are such an important part of the ecosystem, and as well as absorbing water and preventing flooding and providing shelter, food, so on, they are the most incredible carbon sequesters, taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which is obviously what we need to be doing now as much as possible. And also there's been a study that came out very recently that showed that the most effective way of taking carbon dioxide out of the air is through trees, not any other technological, technocratic way, much as we'd like it to be a kind of scientific solution. It's just trees. And that's so easy to do, is to stop cutting down trees and plant new trees. But somehow it's something that is the least profitable, the least exciting alternative for governments around the world.
I mean, the fact that we're talking about deforestation, the EU concluding an agreement that will further deforestation of the forests in Brazil. Like you said, we need to be talking about reforestation as one of the best climate change solutions out there. I mean, of course, the best solution is to keep it in the ground, keep all the fossil fuels in the ground. But what about the CO2 that we already put out of into the atmosphere? Actually, like the researchers claim that if we cover a land roughly the size of the continental US just with trees, it could store up to 205 billion tons of carbon, which is about two-thirds of the carbon that we have already put into the atmosphere.
Wow.
We need to be talking about these things.
Absolutely. And it's not like it's a sacrifice to plant trees. Mm-hmm. I mean, we should be reforesting urban areas. We should be reforesting the whole of this kind of land that we've got that we've been deforesting for centuries, really. And we've lost out in terms of flooding getting worse, in terms of losing biodiversity, in terms of, you know, having fewer amazing natural spaces that we can enjoy. So, yeah, as you say, that's what we should be doing. And actually, the woman that we selected for Women's History Month, Wangari Maathai, was way ahead of the curve on this, wasn't she?
Absolutely.
She was planting trees in Kenya, like starting in the 60s, and realized that was what we should all be doing. So, yeah, as you said, even though Brussels officials are saying this is going to be great for the environment, and they've said that the deal abides by the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015, and that, you know, the Mercosur countries have committed to implement the Paris Global Warming Agreement. And Brazil has included specific commitments on preventing deforestation of the Amazon.
How is that even possible?
Yeah, that's
how
just...
is Mercosur countries have committed to implement the agreement. One of those countries is Brazil.
Yeah.
With Bolsonaro.
And under him, deforestation has increased exponentially. And he's only been in for 7 months. You know, in May, the rate of destruction hit a new record, with an area the size of 2 football pitches disappearing every hour. And that's an 88% increase from a year ago.
It's
just absolutely nonsensical, and it's making the EU look really bad, and it's turning a lot of people against them.
I mean, this guy campaigned and said he would like to open up the forests, Amazon, Cerrado, all these forests for agriculture and mining purposes. The moment he took the office, his government has neutered the environment ministry and then started pushing proposals to remove the protected status for indigenous territories and nature reserves. And the EU is making a deal with him.
Yeah, absolutely. He's been very open about what he wants to do, and his environmental legacy already is just horrendous. You know, he's approved hundreds of new pesticide products already since January. 169 new pesticides, 78 of them containing active ingredients classified as highly hazardous, and 24 contain active ingredients banned in the EU. So first of all, horrible labour conditions for people to be working with these. And secondly, these lower standards, this production is going to be using materials that are banned in the EU. So this is the classic kind of double standard of, you know, European rights and standards at home, and then no standards or protections abroad where you get your raw material. And there's countless reports of rule breaking by Brazilian meat companies An investigation published this week by The Guardian shows how the global market leader JBS is still selling meat from companies that have been fined for deforestation. And as we've already said before, studies clearly show that an increase in beef exploitation is indirectly linked to an increase in deforestation, which is obvious. Mm-hmm. But you need a study to be able to prove that, I guess.
Yeah.
I'd also like to make another point in regarding rule breaking. That's the point about that the EU's also been making about, oh, well, you know, we'd like to temper Bolsonaro a little bit. And this deal is a way to do so because we're going to be creating dialogue about human rights, about environmental rights and, you know, creating spaces and having much more leverage over him. But in fact, this clearly doesn't work. You know, a really good example of this, which my friend CeeLo sent me today, is Japanese whaling. So Japan just signed one of these many agreements with the EU recently, and it came into force this year. And as part of this whole process of negotiating the deal, the subject of Japanese whaling was brought up, and the EU Commission actively said that it would be using this deal and its relationship with Japan to push for the prevention of whaling, and the EU was really committed to stopping whaling, and that this would be kind of, you know, a way to support pushing that agenda of stopping whaling. And
basically what they're saying with this deal and about Bolsonaro's deforestation activities.
Exactly. And Japan has literally just resumed commercial whaling after 30 years.
There you go.
So, I mean, it's just...
There you go.
And let's not forget the most important people, perhaps, in this whole topic, and that's Mercosur's indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
Because Bolsonaro has also, as an inextricable part of his attack on the environment, basically declared war on Brazil's indigenous people, whose right to the land and whose defense of it has long been a big part of the protection that it's enjoyed so far. They've been at the forefront of preventing, you know, illegal loggers and miners. And the fact that their land is protected has been key to stopping it being, you know, sold off by ranchers or miners and so on. I mean, Bolsonaro's views on indigenous people are just absolutely terrifying. And it's horrifyingly dangerous to be an indigenous person in Brazil right now. Let me just read out this quote. "The Brazilian cavalry was very incompetent. Competent, yes, was the American cavalry that decimated its Indians in the past and nowadays does not have this problem in their country." He thinks he's angry because they're stopping him from doing what he wants with the land. He's angry and he believes that they're, you know, savages, basically. It's just, it's a completely like 16th century opinion. And he's even said, you know, we're going to give a rifle carry permit to every farmer. And the reason why this is, you know, really real for indigenous people is that they already get attacked and killed by illegal ranchers and farmers and military type interventions into their land.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Schenker from Survival International, which campaigns for indigenous people's rights and has been following this issue very closely, has said there's been a recent increase in invasions of indigenous lands, such as the Uru-Uwawa Reserve in the Amazon state of Rondônia, by land grabbers, loggers and farmers who felt emboldened by Bolsonaro's rhetoric.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. It's enabling people.
Exactly. And I compare it a bit to Brexit and how that huge vote, which many people interpreted as a vote against immigration and against people of color, has really emboldened a huge outpouring of racism that was always there, but it was kind of suppressed and hidden to come out.
So everything that is in accordance with that rhetoric is now allowed.
Yeah. There's also so much to win from demonizing Brazil's indigenous people because they're sitting on, you know, the most valuable areas of land, perhaps even in the world, because it's just really, you know, amazing, valuable wood and huge areas of land, very fertile and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But Brazil's indigenous peoples have organized resistance in a huge and absolutely fearless and amazing way. And they're really leading the fight against Bolsonaro and his destruction of the environment. But it's not only Brazil's indigenous people that will have a lot to lose from this deal, because farmers in the EU have put up a huge resistance against this, haven't they?
Exactly. So on this side of the Atlantic, the EU farmers are worried about the substantial increase in beef imports from South America, especially Brazil, to the EU countries. So basically, EU farmers have a beef with this.
They definitely have beef. I've seen that joke in every single article I've read about it. You can't not make it. So I respect your right to make it.
Thank you. Thank you. I lost confidence in the middle of the sentence about the joke. It was just all downhill from there. Anyway, so again, referring back to that quote from the commission's website, which said this deal will preserve or protect the sensitive sectors, right? So imagine the EU is going to import that much beef from South America, right? You gave the numbers.
99,000 tons.
Thank you. That will cause mass deforestation of the Amazon, but it also does not match the same standards of traceability, animal welfare, or food safety. But then in the EU, you hold your own farmers to all those standards. Of course they're going to have a disadvantage. Of course they're not going to be able to compete with the farmers from these four countries.
Mm.
So what this deal will do in the EU, it's basically going to widen the gap between what's being asked from European farmers and then what's tolerated for Mercosur producers.
Mm-hmm.
Totally imbalanced. And to be honest, it's just disastrous for the many, many agricultural businesses in the EU.
Yeah, absolutely. And I saw that French farmers were especially up in arms about this. I mean, they're really good at protesting anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But they were just saying, you know, the market's so tight and the balance is so fine.
Yeah.
That this will completely destabilize it. And the fact that this beef will still be cheaper, even though it's coming from halfway across the world, just says so much about the standards that it's being held to.
Exactly.
And it's just, it's completely, it's basically the EU letting down its small farmers. And
sell out. It's a sellout.
Completely. And actually, this is how it's been branded by, you know, a lot of farmers associations, especially in Ireland and in France and Poland, but also in Germany. And they feel like they've been sold out to the automobile industry because this industry just wants to sell more cars in Brazil and Argentina. I like this quote from the head of the German Farmers Association who said, agriculture should not be sacrificed in favor of the automobile industry.
Mm-hmm.
And critics have called this a cows for cars trade deal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, who's winning on both sides? The big corporations, the beef ones in Latin America and the automobile ones in Europe. They both want to sell more of their products. And who loses out? It's, you know, the people and the environment.
Exactly. And that's why this deal looks like a very much a backroom deal with just big businesses like Mercedes, only so that they would get into South America, that market.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're selling out a large part of Europe's most valuable market to the Latin American ranchers and, you know, factory farm units.
Yeah.
And there is a historical context, and there is a reason why this is huge for those automobile corporations. So much of modern Brazil was built on protectionist policies. Since the 1950s, there were a lot of trade barriers and government subsidies, which would force major car makers, including Volkswagen, Ford, Fiat, Mercedes, to set up factories in the country, right?
In Brazil?
Yeah.
Okay.
So their trade policies were based on protectionism, which meant tariffs would foster the growth of national champions that would otherwise be crushed by foreign competitors.
Mm-hmm.
But then around 1990s, Brazil started opening up its economy to the world, especially for foreign investment. For instance, in May 2017, the country sent a formal request to join the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, but they haven't been able to become a member as there was too much political uncertainty in the country. But now that Trump and Bolsonaro are vibing, it's expected that the U.S. Yeah. will show some support so that Brazil could become a member of this organization. I mean, of course, it's not a guarantee, but, you know, it's some progress for Brazil.
Mm.
But then this trade deal is just another step for Brazil to continue that path of opening up their economy to the global market and those automobile corporations getting into the market without having their factories there.
This is an interesting distinction between Trump and Bolsonaro, isn't it? Because in some ways they're so similar, and Bolsonaro is the kind of Trump on speed, like just
Trump on steroids.
Yeah. And he's even started talking like Trump. Like, I don't know if you heard what he said about the deal, but he was like, this is the greatest deal in history.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're so similar in some ways. Yeah. But in this way, it's such a big difference in that Bolsonaro is clearly just like being super neoliberal and opening up the economy. And Trump is so protectionist still.
Exactly. And also, when Bolsonaro was campaigning, no one could tell if he was being a protectionist on trade-related issues, yeah, or more like a global market-friendly candidate. There was some mystery around that. He sounded like he had some protectionist tendencies, but then he then came up with some global market-friendly ideas too. But I guess him agreeing to this deal now shows the characteristics of his trade policies and, you know, going forward, what they're going to be like.
Yeah. And speaking of protectionism, I think it's interesting how this deal has been framed, as we've already talked about, by the EU as a kind of antidote to Trump's protectionism. And Emmanuel Macron, France's president, was like, we are not protectionists, you know, like saying this really proudly. And this is the narrative he's creating that it's meant to make people think, oh, yeah, we're not protectionist like Trump. So this is what we have to be like. And kind of creating this false dichotomy that we're seeing everywhere about, or it's nationalist protectionism or it's open neoliberalism. And that's exactly the opposite of what we want to be telling people. And that's why, you know, this deal makes a mockery, really. In France, for example, where the agricultural sector is huge and where the far right under Marine Le Pen has actually succeeded in appealing to many ecologically minded people by talking about land and landscapes and protection, not just about kind of international deals and climate change as this like intangible thing that we can't really see. They've actually had a really clever, tangible environmental narrative that's worked really well. You know, this whole Mercosur deal will support her narrative that international trade deals and international institutions are just neoliberal interests protecting themselves and that the environment is never at the center. And how the EU can imply that it's standing up to people like Trump while it's legitimizing and trading directly with Trump's 2.0 Brazilian version is just is astounding.
It's offensive too, right? Like it's at a point where you feel like you're being fooled. So I actually found this deal very offensive on a personal level.
Because,
I understand. Let me just explain. Goes on a passionate, angry rant for 20 minutes. All right. Look, I understand the negotiations for this deal have started like 20 years ago. So as a natural result of that, it contains a lot of values of the past, which is more pro-industry, and it doesn't really reflect the current environmental concerns.
Yeah.
But after all, the citizen mobilization, civil disobedience movements, vote for climate, strike for climate, green wave, all of that, going ahead and concluding this deal while saying you're respecting the environment. First of all, you don't respect the environment. What does that even mean? You protect the environment. Yeah. You don't mess up the environment. What is it? Do you respect your house? You protect your house. You clean your apartment. What does that even mean? Respecting the environment.
Yeah. It's the most substanceless thing you can say.
Exactly. It's such an establishment status quo way of branding and trying to sell an agreement that has no way. That is no way protecting the environment or even respecting the environment.
Yeah.
But after all that momentum, if you go ahead and sign this agreement, that's kind of like, well, we don't care, really.
No.
Like, it just shows that all of that doesn't make their way to the top positions.
Yeah.
Where these kinds of decisions are taken, where these kinds of deals are signed, those top positions are still controlled by the same interest, same lobbies, same corporations, same establishment. pro-status quo, of course, why would they be for change? It doesn't benefit them. And that's why you get quotes and deals that says we're going to respect the environment.
Yeah. And I think Emmanuel Macron is a huge example of this because he said, oh, I will not sign the deal if Bolsonaro pulls out of the climate agreement. But then he saw the final deal and Bolsonaro said, yeah, sure. I won't pull out. Yeah. And Macron was like, oh, this is a great deal. And it's like, if you know anything about the environment or climate or you know, politics, he knows what Bolsonaro is like. You know that that's not actually what's going to happen on the ground. So
that's just a show.
It looks really bad for Macron. And, you know, everyone's scales are falling from their eyes regarding his environmental credentials, definitely.
Exactly. So let's talk about what's next.
Yes.
Okay. The commission has concluded this deal. Now it'll be put before the EU Trade Council for ratification. And for this, we need a qualified majority vote. If it passes the EU Trade Council, it's going to go to the European Parliament. But in the Trade Council, under this system, a vote needs 55% of member states, representing at least 65% of the EU population. And if there's a minority blocking the agreement, you need at least 4 council members representing over 35% of the EU population.
Yeah. And countries like Ireland, which feels very strongly about this, and the Irish government was even, you know, considering vetoing the deal because the lobbying was so strong. But in the EU Trade Council, which is made up of each different country's trade ministers, right?
Yeah.
That's going to happen in about 2 years' time, which is just gives you a sense of how long these deals take to negotiate.
Absolutely, yeah.
As you said, one country can't veto it. So it's going to have to assemble support from close to a third of member states if it wants to defeat the measure.
Yeah.
And, you know, if some would say that you've got the most chance of defeating it at the European Parliament level, because also that's where you've got the most sympathetic voices, sympathetic to defeating it, I mean, because, you know, Greens and some socialists and Democrats have been really vocal in opposing it, right? Yeah, and this might be one of the few times where protectionist nationalists and Greens may be uneasy bedfellows because they might ask kind of deal.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see the protectionists and nationalists, that wing in the European Parliament vetoing this deal, because ironically they're pro-industry, pro-corporations, even if that means, you know, that this kind of a global deal is going to go through.
Yeah.
But those are protections of nationalists, like very right wing of the parliament, right? So I have some receipts from Twitter. From
get them out. This is where we do our research, Twitter.
Well, I was quite disappointed when I saw these tweets from the former leader of the Lib Dems, Liberals in the European Parliament, now known as Renew Europe. Let's go back to the 8th of January. He says, how can some politicians still deny climate change? We need a leap forward on climate with far more ambitious goals and immediate action. 2nd of April 2019. It's clear we need drastic action to avert a climate catastrophe. Under the right leadership, the EU can play the radical role it should. And then about Bolsonaro, on the 2nd of January, he said, Bolsonaro's presidency is a threat to the Amazon rainforest, the world's lungs when we need them the most. I hope the EU will encourage Brazil to maintain its commitments under the Paris Climate Agreement. There is no planet B. Now, 28th of June, same guy, same Twitter account, probably a different political advisor or a press officer intern. He said, quote, after 20 years of negotiations, the EU and Mercosur today reached a political agreement on trade. Congrats to the EU Commissioner on Trade for striking the largest trade deal the EU has ever concluded, bringing Europe, South America, closer together. So yeah. I am not counting on even the moderate support in the parliament.
No, totally. I mean, this is the group that Emmanuel Macron's his party sit in. So this is all, you know, how they feel about the environment is it's a kind of pro-capitalist way of looking at environmental protection, where you'll do it as much as it doesn't harm
anything. That always prevails.
It's never the, you're never going to center anything around sustainability or the environment. They're just all words.
Yeah. But so let's say the agreement passes all these hurdles, then all the trade elements that it contains will be phased in over 6 years. So, you know, it's a long process, 20 years of negotiations, and then, you know, many more years in the being discussed within the institutions, EU institutions, and then a phase-in process.
Yeah, so there's a lot of chance for resistance as well, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it's not over yet, right? There's a huge backlash, resistance, and opposition.
And with groups like the Greens EFA group in European Parliament, you know, newly strong, it's fourth now rather than the little sixth one. They're going to have they're going to have more clout, so they could really make this quite tricky, I think.
Exactly. Well, hopefully.
Yeah. and yeah, we've got a statement by Molly Scott-Cato, MEP, who's the British MEP from the Green Party, who said even back in 2017, you know, the European Parliament has a strong commitment to rainforest conservation and sustainable forest management in Brazil. MEPs will have a final say on the Mercosur trade deal, and Greens will vote against any agreement that increases trade in raw materials whilst threatening the most important rainforest on the planet. And seeing as it's unlikely that the deal will change from having this at its very core, I think we can, you know, rest assured that the Greens are going to be really active in trying to prevent this deal from going through. It's going to be interesting to see what happens next.
All right, folks, that's our show. You can follow us and show us some love on Twitter at Big Green Pulp Pod. You can find us on any podcast apps, iTunes, Spotify, and SoundCloud.
And if you want to help us make green politics more accessible, subscribe and support us by leaving us a rating or a review. Thank you so much, and see you soon.